I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My guest today, Dr. Dale Bredesen, is internationally recognized as an expert in the mechanism of neurodegenerative diseases, such as Alzheimer's disease. He graduated from Caltech, then earned his MD from Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. He served as chief resident in neurology at the University of California, San Francisco, before joining Nobel laureate Stanley Prusiner's laboratory at UCSF as an NIH postdoctoral fellow. He held faculty positions at UC in San Francisco, UC in Los Angeles, and the University of California, San Diego. Dr. Bredesen directed the program Aging at the Burnham Institute before coming to Duke Institute in 1998 as its founding president and CEO. Dr. Bredesen has mentored many, many physicians and PhD learners in his lab, presented over 300 papers internationally, written over 200 peer-reviewed papers, written numerous book chapters and abstracts, written several books, including his recent The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline, received numerous patents and honors and grants. In addition, recently he is interviewed on many television and radio shows, including Dr. Oz. You can see more information on his curriculum vitae at drbredesen.com/Dr. Bredesen. The uniform failure of recent drug trials in Alzheimer's disease has highlighted the crucial need for a more accurate understanding of the fundamental nature of Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Bredesen's research has led to new insight that explains the erosion of memory seen in Alzheimer's disease and has opened the door to a new therapeutic approach. He has found evidence that Alzheimer's disease stems from an imbalance in nerve cell signaling. In the normal brain, specific signals foster nerve connections and memory making, while balancing signals support memory breaking, allowing irrelevant information to be forgotten. But in Alzheimer's disease, the balance of these opposing signals is disturbed. Nerve connections are suppressed and memory are lost. This model is contrary to popular dogma that Alzheimer's is a disease of toxicity caused by the accumulation of sticky plaques in the brain. Dr. Bredesen believes that amyloid beta peptides, the source of the plaque, has a normal function in the brain, promoting signals that allow some of the nerve connections to lapse. Thus, the increase in the peptide that occurs in Alzheimer's disease shifts the memory-making versus memory-breaking balance in favor of memory loss. This work has led to the identification of several new therapeutic candidates that are currently in preclinical trial. Dr. Bredesen's novel insight into the fundamental nature of Alzheimer's disease recently attracted an investment of $3.5 million toward a $10 million goal for initial clinical trials of this new therapeutics. The generous support came from the private venture capitalist Douglas Rosenberg, who is helping to fund the Alzheimer's Drug Discovery Network, centered at the Buck Institute. The unit is screening drug candidates to find those that can preserve a healthy balance in the signaling pathways that support memory. Dr. Bredesen's work on nerve signaling is also the focus of a collaboration between the Buck Institute and the BioMarin Pharmaceutical Incorporated, which is seeking treatments for a rare form of Alzheimer's disease, early onset familial Alzheimer's disease, which may develop in people as young as age 30. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Dr. Bredesen.
Thank you, Dr. Helvey.
I look forward to hearing about your research and your writing about Alzheimer's. Now, you published studies in 2014 and 2016 that were the first to document reversal of cognitive behavior in Alzheimer's disease. What has been happening in your research and in your training of other health professionals since that time?
Right. This was reversal of cognitive decline that these people had. And we had people who were either in had a full-blown Alzheimer's disease or had either MCI or SCI, MCI being pre-Alzheimer's and SCI being pre-Alzheimer's. And these were the first to document improvement as we published back in 20, as you mentioned, in 2014 and 2016. And since then, we published the first 20. Now we've had over 1,000 people who are currently on this program. We've had continued good results. We've trained over 600 practitioners from seven different countries and all over the United States in how to use this particular protocol. Mm-hmm. We've continued to evolve the protocol. We have a computer-based algorithm that helps to determine what are the different contributors. Mm-hmm. We've defined subtypes that we published in 2015, showing that Alzheimer's is not a single disease, but this actually has subtypes.
I found that interesting when you said that there were three distinct syndromes and that they were all different and they acted different, they started at different times, etc. And could you explain this a little to us?
Sure. So what we found is that surprisingly, what we call Alzheimer's disease, as you know, this is really a pathologist's diagnosis. You look mm-hmm. and you find plaques and tangles and neurodegeneration, and we call that Alzheimer's disease. But if you look at what's actually driving the process, the surprise was that, in fact, this is a protective response that your brain makes to three fundamentally different types of insults. Number one, if you have any chronic inflammation, whether it's from Lyme disease, whether it's from various fungi, whether it's from oral bacteria, any of these things, or whether it's actually from eating things like trans fats or too much sugar, any of those things that cause a chronic inflammatory state that cause your brain to make amyloid as a protective response, because the amyloid is actually antimicrobial. And this was shown by a group at Harvard that includes Robert Moyer and includes Rudy Tanzi and others. So anything that causes chronic inflammation can lead to Alzheimer's, and we call that type 1 inflammatory or hot Alzheimer's disease. Then there's type 2, which is atrophic. So if you withdraw support, you know, you have about 1 quadrillion synapses in your brain, tremendous network there. And anything you do to withdraw the support, whether it's through estradiol or thyroid hormone or vitamin D or nerve growth factor or brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and on, there are dozens mm-hmm. of these critical hormones and trophic factors and nutrients that are all there supporting that structure. If you withdraw those, especially if you do it quickly, then in fact, you undergo a downsizing that includes the production of amyloid. So that's type 2 or cold Alzheimer's. And then 3, it turns out also that amyloid is a very good binder of a number of toxins, such as divalent metals like mercury or copper or iron. Also, things like mycotoxins, toxins from mold, these things are also bound. So amyloid is actually quite a good antitoxin, basically. Mm-hmm. But when you have these sorts of insults, your brain responds in a way that is actually attempting to protect it. So if you think of it, you can think of this amyloid that collects in the brains of the Alzheimer's patients mm-hmm. a little bit like a mobile electrified fence. You know, if you've got the bad guys breaching your borders, and you say, okay, well, I'm going to pull back here. I'm going to put this stuff down. You can't cross here. I'm going to live now in a slightly smaller country. I'm pulling back a little bit, but I'm going to put this stuff down. That's a a little bit what's happening in the brain of a patient with Alzheimer's. There is a downsizing associated with protection.
Mm-hmm. And you say that it is different than cancer, say, which has cells that have gone wrong and proliferated. And in Alzheimer's, you have something good that is going on with the amyloid, but apparently it's gone too far. So what's the amyloid plaque attempting to do in type 1?
It is a protective response. So you are producing this as an antimicrobial. So it is actually successful at killing things and protecting you from things like fungi and spirochetes and bacteria and viruses and things like that. But in so doing, it's a little bit like if you've got a police state, you've got the police around, they are protecting you. On the other hand, there are going to be some collateral damage. There's going to be some fatality if you're living in that sort of state day in and day out.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this is why the whole point here is we need to take a very, very different look at this illness, and we need to have protection and prevention. And this is why I mentioned in the book that everybody over 45 should have a, quote, cognoscopy. Everyone should see where they stand.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, dementia, which is now the third leading cause of death in the United States and the number one cause of death in the United Kingdom, this should actually be a rare disease if we all get evaluated ahead of time and then do prevention or early reversal.
Mm-hmm. And how do you treat then type 1?
So type 1, you want to identify, and for each of these, again, we have a computer-based algorithm, so it just generates an initial listing of what percentage for each subtype is the contributor to your risk or to your ongoing problem, and then we'll generate an initial plan that you can then carry out with your physician. And so it includes many things because, again, you have to remember, this is not simply one problem. There, we typically find 10 to 25 different contributors. So you need to find out what is causing this ongoing inflammation. Is it your diet? Is it your lifestyle? Is it a leaky gut, for example, turning out to be very common? Is it an ongoing infection? For example, we had one woman who had ongoing inflammation. It turned out she had actually had a foreign illness, undiagnosed. And what had happened was she was treated for Lyme disease successfully 10 years previously, but then had a co-infection. When the ticks bite you, they have up to 70 different organisms, not just Lyme. Lyme is the most famous, but they often give you Bartonella or Babesia, and this woman happened to have Babesia, or they have Ehrlichia or other organisms. So you need to identify those. Then we usually recommend that people resolve the ongoing inflammation, and that's accomplished by something called specialized pro-resolving mediators. I go into this in the book a little bit about what these are, where you get them, those sorts of things. And then, of course, you want to remove the source of the inflammation. And then, of course, then you want to have the anti-inflammatories, things like omega-3s and curcumin, which decrease the ongoing inflammation. If you have a leaky gut, it's important to know that, and it's important to heal that up. And you can do that with things like bone broth and things like colostrum and things like slippery elm. All of these things can help heal a leaky gut. And then, of course, you need to understand what's the status of the microbiome. So there are a number of things that can be done, and this is exactly why we have trained the many practitioners who now use this approach.
When you mentioned bone broth, I was surprised because there seems to be a debate going on, at least on Facebook, about whether the long cooking of the bones pulls out lead and other metals not.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so certainly you want to know your metal status. And so you're right. Because of that controversy, some people have moved toward other things like colostrum. Now, colostrum has its own issues because it does have a dairy type source. And we typically want to get people off dairy. But if you have a leaky gut, bone broth has positives and negatives, as you just indicated. Colostrum has positives and negatives. People also use, as I mentioned, things like slippery elm, which also you want to coat that and you want to get that healed up. And then, of course, the most important is not to do the things that are going to open it up again, things like sodas and tremendous amount of stress and a very high carb intake. All those things can be damaging to the gut lining.
Then, Dr. Bredesen, can you tell us about type 2 Alzheimer's, what brings it on, and when it manifests?
Absolutely. So type 2 is a response to trophic withdrawal. So you can imagine, again, you have approximately 1 quadrillion synapses in your brain. It's really a remarkable computer that you have inside your skull, and it has dozens of things that are needed to support that wonderful network. If you withdraw those, then you can get a downsizing. And so what you need to do is measure the status, and we do this on when blood tests, you measure the status of these various things. You want to know what your vitamin D status is, mm-hmm. and your estrogen, and progesterone and pregnenolone and free T3 and free T4 and testosterone, on and on. So you want to know these things, and you want to know if you are in the optimal range. And a critical piece here is, as you know, as physicians, we typically are looking for, quote, within normal limits, mm-hmm. which is up to 2 standard deviations below the mean. So what I always tell the patients is, we're now going to treat you like a competitive athlete. When your brain is not working correctly, we need to optimize all of these things. And when you do that, you see unprecedented improvements. So in people with this type 2, and I'll give you an example, there one woman from New York in her early 70s, very typical story with the type 2, very difficult with memory, very poorly, scoring at the 9th percentile in online cognitive testing. And she had low for all of those, low pregnenolone, low vitamin D, and on and on. And when those were corrected, slowly improved over 6 months from the 9th percentile to the 97th percentile. So she's actually doing very, very well. And again, correcting these things was absolutely critical. And she had, you know, PET scan proven Alzheimer's disease. So this was not, you know, not someone's imagination. She had true Alzheimer's disease. So the point here is that these are the things that actually cause the signaling in your brain that leads to Alzheimer's. The old-fashioned notion is that Alzheimer's is mysterious. We don't know what causes it. Well, this is a little bit like saying the person died from fever. And you say, well, fever due to what? Well, fever syndrome. You know, that's 16th century medicine where people say you got something, we don't know what it's from. In 21st century medicine, instead of just asking what it is, Alzheimer's, fever, whatever, we ask why it is. Why did you get this problem? Whether it's type 2 diabetes, whether it's, you know, leaky gut, what have you, why did it happen? And then you want to address all of the different contributors. And I should add, there's also a type 1.5. So when you have a tremendous amount of sugar in your diet and you develop insulin resistance, mm-hmm. you actually have both the inflammation of type 1 because of the advanced glycation end products that occur when you have extra sugar. And of course, as you know, it actually binds to, sticks to your protein to make glycated protein. But it also gives you an atrophic response because you now are resistant to the supportive effects of insulin in your brain. So in fact, you get some of type 1 and some of type 2. So we call that type 1.5 or sweet glycotoxic or sweet Alzheimer's disease. And the good news is that is a relatively easy one to fix when someone has that problem. Reproducing the insulin sensitivity is critical and people will get better from that.
Do you know, this is so complex. I had no idea that Alzheimer's as a process is so complex. And it must require a lot of testing.
Well, you're absolutely right in that you need to do the tests that actually look at what's causing the problem. So mm-hmm. as you know, if you go into many Alzheimer's centers today, they will check things like your serum sodium and your serum potassium, which really have little to do with why you developed Alzheimer's. And then you will be told, okay, you have Alzheimer's disease. It's a mysterious illness and there's nothing we can do for it. The medicines that we have don't work very well and nothing's going to happen. You have a terminal illness. And the reality is, as with all chronic illnesses, there are drivers to this. And I should add that, you know, one of the problems we have in medicine today is that we are still practicing 20th century medicine. So what happened was 100 years ago, most of us were dying of these simple illnesses, tuberculosis, pneumococcal pneumonia, diphtheria. These were simple infectious illnesses. You get a medicine, you treat them, you kill the bugs, you get better over time.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is we've used that same strategy for complex chronic illnesses, Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and it's why we have not been as successful with those. We've been using a checkers strategy for a chess match. That's problem. So when you look at these complex chronic illnesses, you need to look at a larger data set. There really is what I call a complexity gap. We have a very complex organism that we're trying to make better, human beings, and we're doing it with very tiny data sets that do not represent what is actually going on. So we are absolutely right. We need to expand those so that we look at the critical drivers that are underlying the process. And when we address those drivers, things go much, much better.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the way medicine is practiced has influenced a change in patients? For example, what I mean is, like when my sister had small children, I used to say to her, well, what did the doctor prescribe? And she'd say so-and-so, and I'd say, and did he tell you the side effects and all? No, I just trust my doctor. So everyone, or most everyone, trusted what the doctor said, and they never questioned. Whereas it seems like more and more with the internet and some of the technology that we have, people are taking their health more in their own hands, and doing a lot of research, both of what the symptoms are, but also what the doctor says and what the doctor doesn't say. And so it's more like patients are more invested in their own health than they were years ago.
I couldn't agree more. This, I think, has been a good thing. And as you know, Dr. Eric Topol has written a book, The Patient Will See You Now. And so absolutely, patients search on the internet. And, you know, let's be fair. The patient knows his or her own symptoms far better than the doctor does. So the patient is equipped to say, hey, I know I'm having these problems. So in a way, it really requires a team. The patient knowing the symptoms better and having done the internet searches and the research ahead of time, and then the doctor having all the different qualifications and many years in school. I know there's a doctor's coffee mug that says, your internet search is not equivalent to my MD degree and the years of research that I've done. So both of them have something to offer, and it's very complementary. And when things work the best, they work together to get the optimal outcome. But absolutely, this old idea that I'm just going to be completely passive and let my doctor tell me what to do really is not the optimal way. And I think most people are now doing their own searches. And I know many doctors will tell me that patients show up in their office, having done their internet searches and being quite sophisticated about what they have.
I think sometimes it's more of a two-way process also, because if you get a doctor that is flexible, you can introduce new things to that doctor. Now, I have a woman doctor, and she's relatively young, but she's also very flexible. And I have AFib. And so one of the things that I take is natokinase. And I feel that since the natokinase will eat up clots, then I don't need to worry as much about stroke. And so I mentioned this to the doctor, and she looks on the computer and she said, oh, there's a lot of research on that, and it's all very positive. Go ahead, use it. So,
and different doctors have different responses to these things. Many doctors will say, I didn't learn this in medical school, so it must not be worth anything.
Right. And the other thing I get their eyes open when I say, well, my team also includes a medical intuitive. And I consult one in Canada that is outstanding. I mean, he will tell me, like, I had pain in my chest area. And I called and I said, I have pain in my chest. He said, it's not in your chest, it's your back. He said the vertebrae had been displaced or something. I said, that's not possible. He said, oh, yeah. He said, if you were here, I would push it back in. So I went to a chiropractor, and guess what? He was right. And so many times he has told me things that I thought weren't even possible, and yet he was right.
Interesting.
Now, he's not 100% accurate, But he's very accurate. And, you know, he's available. Like, I can send him an email message and he'll email right back. You know, and that's important when you get to my age at 85. And, you know, a lot of things happen. And, you know, it's nice to have someone that is available like that. So my team includes a medical intuitive.
Interesting. Well, yeah, if it works, you know, that's the bottom line here is that there's really only one compass, and that is, can we make people better? And what is the optimal way to do so?
Now, can you tell us then what the amyloid is attempting to do in type 3?
Absolutely. So if you look at what amyloid does, not only does it kill bacteria and kill microbes, but it also is a very, very tight binder of a number of different toxins. And for example, it is one of the tightest binders for copper, as a simple example. So in fact, if you start having exposure to damaging metals, whether you're talking about mercury or very high exposure to copper or to iron, for example, you will actually produce more of this amyloid, which binds it and prevents the toxicity from the metals, or at least reduces the toxicity based on the binding. So that's another thing where, you know, you are making this as a protectant. It also is produced in response to things like biotox. And as you probably know, molds, for example, make many different toxins, Stachybotrys, Penicillium, Aspergillus. These molds all make various toxins, such as trichothecines and ochratoxin A, and aflatoxin and gliotoxin. So these are all things that basically you've got these molds trying to fight. And they're literally fighting with you. And they are often doing so because they've been exposed to things like treated wood, things like that. So in fact, it is a response. And unfortunately, a lot of us are exposed to these things without knowing it. And so people will start having cognitive decline, and the doctors will have no idea that this is actually related, that one of the key contributors can be biotoxins.
And how then would you treat that?
So it's critical to identify where these toxins are coming from and what they are, and to remove, number one is to remove the source. So if you are living in a house that has a high ERMI score, that's E-R-M-I, which is for the EPA, so the Environmental Protection Agency has its own scoring system, EPA Relative Mold Index. And if you are living in a home that has a high index, and especially if you are genetically predisposed to be hypersensitive to this, and you can actually find that out on a simple blood test, you want to know what your HLA-DRDQ is, then in fact, you can develop all sorts of different illnesses related to this exposure. And so you need to remove the source. Then you need to remove the toxins. So you need to have the appropriate glutathione, for example, in your system to reduce this toxin and to secrete the toxin. And then you need to look at things like things that will bind up the toxin. So things like not only the glutathione, but things like cholestyramine or Welchol, things like that. And then, in fact, there are trophic factors that are actually helpful. And actually, Dr. Shoemaker from Maryland developed a wonderful protocol to treat this. And he uses, among other things, intranasal VIP, which is a peptide that supports brain synapses. So in fact, there is a whole set of things that can be done. And for optimal outcome, if you have this type 3 Alzheimer's, you need to address these things.
So you're actually detoxing too. That's interesting.
Absolutely. That's a critical. So you are both detoxing and removing the source and removing any of the sorts of microbes potentially producing these toxins.
That sounds like a good public health concept where you're dealing with reducing the force of the environment and the agent and building up the host.
You know, that's such an interesting and important point. The greatest success of medicine in the 20th century was to reduce the infectious illnesses through a wonderful combination of developing antibiotics and public health measures. What we need to do in the 21st century is combining programmatics, which is this combination of therapies where you're looking at all these different pieces together, just what we've been talking about here and what we use for cognitive decline, with public health measures, just as you said. We need public health measures. We need to know who's living in moldy homes and who's not, who's got exposure to these various pathogens, who's got exposure to toxins. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of toxins that we are exposed to in the water, in the air, in the soil, all mm-hmm. of these things, mm-hmm. and much more so than in the past. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when we evaluate people, most people have multiple toxins that are potentially contributing to cognitive decline. And so what are you doing? Your body is responding to these by making this amyloid. So really, amyloid is part of your innate immune system. And again, it is there to protect you. But as you said earlier, it is also downsizing.
At this point, you have a fairly large sample. Is that correct?
Over 1,000 people now, yes.
Wow. And based on that, can you give us the percentages of people that have type 1, type 2, type 3?
Yeah. So what we find is that, and again, it's important to note that many people have contributions from more than one. It's rare that we see that it's 100% of one type or another. So most people have some, but they will have a dominant one, no question.
Mm-hmm.
So what we find is that the type 3s only represent about 15 to 20% overall. However, some degree of contribution from the toxins is in more like 60%. So many people have contributions from toxins. And then what we find is the type 2s are relatively common, and they represent about 40% overall. And then the type 1s and 1.5s represent the remaining 40%. So very common to have the glycotoxic. The mm-hmm. pure type 1, just inflammatory with nothing else, relatively uncommon. So usually people have some from the type 2 and or some from the glycotoxic. So it's about, if you think about it, it's about 40-40-20. The thing I should say, mm-hmm. they are different in that the type 1s tend to be the inflammatories. These are people typically in their 60s. They can be a little younger or older, but that's kind of a typical person. They're often insulin resistant. They're often overweight. The type 2s are often a little bit older people. These are people who are atrophic. They're often more on the thin side. They're often in their 70s. They're often very low in their trophic support. And they often present with a very focused loss of the ability to form new memories, whereas they're very intact otherwise. They can drive a car, at least early in the process, they can drive a car, they can play tennis, they can talk to their friends, they can do all these things, but they don't remember new information.
Mm-hmm.
And then the type 3s are very, very different. They are often in their early 50s. These are people with toxic exposure.
Mm-hmm.
It often occurs around the time of menopause. What it turned out is that you store these toxins, you sequester them in your bones when you are young. So as you enter menopause, you begin to release these as you get more osteoclastic activity. As you know, you may get osteoporosis in the distant future,
mm-hmm.
but you're just at the beginning of that process as your hormones have declined. So what do? You are releasing these toxins from the bones. Things like mercury, things like mycotoxins are now coming back out and causing problems. These people are the ones that typically present with a non-amnestic presentation. So in other words, they will often have difficulty with organizing or calculating or recognizing things visually or finding the right word. So it's a quite different presentation from the type 2s.
You answered the question I was going to ask, and that had to do with age and all. So you're picking up on me. So you talked about three different syndromes and about how they're affected by diet, by microbes, by nutrition, by toxins, and so forth. Do genetics play a role?
Absolutely. Genetics play a key role, but it's important to note that genetics are not the final arbiter. In other words, you can do a tremendous amount. This old notion that there's nothing you can do to prevent, reverse, or delay cognitive decline is mm-hmm. really out of date. There is a tremendous amount you can do, and there are now multiple groups pointing out that there is prevention. We have published the first reversals, but there are other groups that have also published on prevention. So, here the genetics in a number of ways. First and foremost, you want to know your ApoE status. So ApoE is a protein that carries lipids, and it comes in three different alleles. You get one from your mom and one from your father. And so you can be APOE2-3 or 3-3 or 3-4. So they can come as 2-3 and 4. And for example, I checked myself. I'm an APOE3-3. So that means I don't have any copies of APOE4. That's the one that is the risk factor for Alzheimer's. So if you have zero copies of APOE4, your lifetime risk is right around 9%.
Oh.
Doesn't mean you're not going to get it, but it's about 1 out of 11. If you are a single copy of APOE4, then you have about a 30% risk. If you have two copies of APOE4, then you are well over 50% risk. In other words, more likely that you will get it during your lifetime than that you won't. The good news is, there's a tremendous amount that can be done. And there's a website, APOE4.info, in which there are about 1,500 people from around the world who all share information, all APOE4 positive, all helping with the various parts of the program. And they're virtually all on the protocol or on some variation of the protocol that we published.
And
but secondly, in addition to APOE, there are other genes. I mentioned HLA-DRDQ, which is extremely important for whether you're going to get type 3. Most of the people that get type 3 have this hypersensitivity, and that represents about 25% of the population. So going back to APOE for a minute, 75 million Americans have a single copy of APOE4. 7 million Americans have two copies, and we'd like to identify all of them and prevent all of them from getting Alzheimer's disease.
So what type of Alzheimer's would they be at risk of if they have that gene?
Right. So the ones with APOE4 are at risk for both type 1 and type 2. They rarely get type 3. And in fact, APOE4 seems to be something of a protector against the type 3. However, again, they occasionally do get it. The APOE3s tend to get the type 3 when they do get Alzheimer's disease, or sometimes the type 2. So again, APOE4 is something that's associated with more inflammation, which is why they tend to have more of the type 1s, and they also have more type 2. The HLA-DRDQs are the ones that are typically getting type 3. Then there are over 100 other genes that can confer some risk. It's not as striking as with APOE4, but a number of genes, TREM2 and vitamin D receptor and CR1 and on and on and on. There are other genes that also can confer risk.
Mm-hmm. The APOE4, what would you say to people that have that?
I would say, first of all, that everyone over the age of 45 should have a, quote, cognoscopy, get a baseline, check your genetics, check your biochemical parameters, and if appropriate, go ahead and get on a prevention program now so that we reduce the number. We want to reduce the global burden of dementia, and if everyone were to get on the right program, that would certainly be possible. And this goes back to what you said earlier about public health, and this is something that we can address in a public health sort of mechanism.
What is Cognoscope?
Right. So the idea, and people have said, you know, that's a bad term to use because it sounds so much like colonoscopy. Well, you know, it's easy to remember. That's why I mention it.
Mm-hmm.
So colonoscopy, we should all get when we're 50, of course. And so we recommend anyone over 45 get a cognoscopy. And that's basically just combining the following. You want to have a blood test that can give you both some of the genetics and also the biochemistry. Then you want to have an online cognitive assessment. Very simple. You can do it in 30 minutes. You can do it with a simple MoCA test, which is freely available online, or you can do it with things like Cogstate or Lumosity or Brain HQ or CNS Vital Signs. There are lots of these things that you can use very inexpensively to check your own cognitive status. Now, if you have no symptoms, that's all you need. If you have already started to have symptoms, we recommend also people get an MRI with volumetrics. So in other words, you want a computer to give you a percentile sizing for your hippocampus and other areas of the brain. Hippocampus is affected early in Alzheimer's disease, so you can see where things stand. So these are all critical things to do.
Now, when I have a colonoscopy again, I want the one that has the camera in the capsule, right?
Right. Yeah. And so this is much easier. Yeah, this is much easier, you know, that you don't have to worry about that. The good news about the cognoscopy is that it's not a procedure like that. It's just some blood testing, much, mm-hmm. much easier to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you had a family listening that had someone that needed help, what should they do and what could they expect to happen?
Very good point. Well, I would, first of all, I would check out the book because the book itself, which is called The End of Alzheimer's, goes through all of these things and gives you the background, gives you the specific information, what tests to get, mm-hmm. et cetera. And then you want to find out where is a doctor who has been trained specifically on this approach. And there are, as I mentioned, over 600 practitioners worldwide who've been trained with this. And we have another 200 coming to Miami in December, mm-hmm. another 200 in London in April. So we're continuing to train more and more people on this approach. There's certainly people wherever you are, there's going to be somebody nearby, and you can see where they are. You can go on the website, drbredesen.com, and that will show you where these people are.
Great. And are they certified, or do they just take
these people have? Yeah, so these people have been through a specific course that we give mm-hmm. with the Institute for Functional Medicine.
Mm-hmm. Great, good. Then is there anything else you'd like to say before we look at your books, services, and products?
Well, the only thing I think is just that, you know, dementia should be a rare illness. This is unfortunately a very common illness. We are, to some extent, giving this to ourselves, increasing our own risk factors. And there's actually a chapter in the book called How to Give Yourself Alzheimer's, because unfortunately, many of us are contributing to our own cognitive decline. Let's all work together to reduce the global burden of dementia. If this is something in your family, if this is something where you have a loved one who is far advanced in the process, then everybody else in the family should get a cognoscopy. Let's make sure that nobody else gets the problem.
Is Alzheimer's a result of our environment and our lifestyle? Or is it something that has been around but was called something else?
Well, both. So, in fact, the dementia has been around, as you know, for thousands mm-hmm. and beyond thousands of years. However, is on the rise. It has been a problem because of many contributors. Because of the contributors, we are not really, we did not evolve to live with this sort of lifestyle. We didn't evolve to have so much stress. We didn't mm-hmm. evolve to have too little sleep. We didn't evolve to eat processed foods. We didn't evolve to have exposure to mycotoxins. We didn't evolve to have soils that are depleted of some of the vitamins that we actually need. All of these things are contributors. We didn't evolve to eat trans fats. We didn't evolve to eat sugars. Mm-hmm. We can handle our, you know, human bodies can handle about 15 grams or so of simple carbohydrates. One single soda has about three times that. Mm-hmm. So in fact, you know, we just didn't evolve to live the way we are living. And mm-hmm. so this is a major contributor to our cognitive decline.
Mm-hmm. At age 85, am I off the hook or do I still have to think that's a possibility?
You know, that's a really good point. So there are some studies. No question, the risk increases well into the 80s. So definitely, you want to continue to do all the good things you've mm-hmm. been doing. Keep the sugar out of your diet. I don't know if you've ever checked your ketone status, but the approach that we recommend drives people into mild ketosis, mm-hmm. which is inhibitory of cognitive decline. But, you know, you make a good point that people over 100, when autopsies are done with so-called super centenarians who have lived to 110, they typically do not have Alzheimer's disease.
Oh.
So it's mm-hmm. not inevitable, mm-hmm. but you are still in the area where you have it at this time in your life. So you want to continue to do things right. And at some point, good idea to check these various parameters as I outlined in the book.
Mm-hmm. I know it's multifactorial, but do you think that the GMOs have a role in causing this disease?
I think it's very likely that they do. Mm-hmm. Point. Why? Because they change your microbiome. That is another toxin, and we're all being exposed to these toxins. When these toxins affect you, your body has to deal with them, has to bind them, have to excrete them. So, in fact, getting rid of these things is an important thing. And, of course, because of these toxins, that actually lowers your glutathione so that you're now at risk for exposure to other things. So I think it's likely. Now, there's no proof yet. As you know, GMOs have absolutely been implicated in cancers, but it's not clear yet that they've been implicated in cognitive decline, but I would be very concerned.
Then, Dr. Bredesen, can you tell us about books, services, products, and how the listeners can reach you?
Great point. So you can reach me at info@drbredesen.com. And the book, which is called The End of Alzheimer's, came out on August 22nd. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for the last 5 weeks. You can actually get it in Walmart, in Costco, anywhere that books are sold, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all of the above. You can check that out for specific tests. And that will also give you websites and also give you information online.
And do you have a practice?
So I am predominantly a researcher. I rarely see patients. Occasionally I do. So I am a research physician. So mostly what we've done is to train other physicians. So what we've done is through the last 28 years that we've had the lab open, looked at the driving mechanisms for neurodegeneration. And we're hoping, of course, to extend this same sort of approach to Parkinson's and Lewy body. And you may know, for example, Dr. Terry Walls is having very good results with multiple sclerosis. And has written a book on this, actually, and it turns out to be a somewhat similar approach to the one that we've taken. So I think you're going to see more and more success with neurodegeneration. Until now, you could argue that that has been the area of greatest biomedical failure. As they say, everyone knows a cancer survivor. No one knows an Alzheimer's survivor. But we described the first ones.
You mentioned that there's a list then of the practitioners that have gone through your program. Could you give us that website again for anyone that might want it?
Of course, at drbredesen.com.
And so would you spell
D-R-B-R-E-S-E-N.
Great. Well, I appreciate this very much. I had no idea that it was so complex and that there was so much information on it. You know, the people I've known, you know, have told me that they don't know this and they don't know what to do and all that. If I see something like I saw that coconut oil might help, I send things on to people that I know. But it's much more complex and much more information than I had any idea that was available. So I think this is fantastic.
Well, thank you, Dr. Helvey. And I think that you're going to see an explosion of information and much, much better outcomes in the upcoming decade.
Great. I look forward to that, right?
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Because we have some time left today, I would like to talk with you about my new Cancer Foundation and an opportunity that I think will be of interest to you. My new Cancer Foundation can be found at www.holisticcancerfoundation.com. On the site, you will see first a video of the foundation. You will also see the goals, which are education, research, and patient care. I have an impressive board and advisory board for this foundation, and you can look at these on the site. I have worked for over a year getting content on the site, including interviews with cancer patients and doctors, cancer research, cancer treatment, and what is different on my site is research on mental, spiritual interventions and interviews with experts for interviews like affirmations, visualization, prayer, meditation, gratitude, forgiveness, and many others. These are included because I believe that disease results from multiple factors and consequently a holistic approach is necessary for recovering from cancer. To me, prayer, faith, optimism, and others are as important in treatment as medication, supplements, diet, and other interventions. I have experienced to support this belief. Having used a holistic approach since 1970, when I volunteered as a camp nurse for the Edgar Cayce Organization, It was natural to use this approach when I was diagnosed with lung cancer in 1974. Curing this disease with all natural, holistic interventions, I continued using the approach in my personal life and with clients, and am now considered a pioneer in holistic health. I have worked for the past 5 to 6 months on the website section on prevention of cancer. This resulted in a soft-covered booklet for $14.95 and a hard-covered booklet for $24.95 available on my website, www.holisticcancerfoundation.com, or on Amazon or Barnes & Nobles. The booklet is 174 pages long and is titled Reducing Your Cancer Risk, A Holistic Approach. First, as a longtime educator, I like to start my writing with a theoretical framework in which to place the content. So there is first a theoretical framework based upon public health concepts. This framework will basically look at, first, ways to reduce the risk of known environmental carcinogens, and second, ways to strengthen the host against environmental and other carcinogens. Content on reducing the effect of known environmental carcinogens include electromagnetic waves, toxic chemicals such as BPA, formaldehyde, toxic metals such as aluminum and mercury, and last, ultraviolet waves. For all areas, there will be research related to the carcinogen, what you can do to reduce the risk, and an interview with an expert for many of these. The second part looks at ways to strengthen the host or you against carcinogens. It includes areas such as physical activities, nutrition including genetically modified organisms, organic food, etc., fluids, water and milk, supplements, vitamins, minerals, immune builders, sleep, smoking cessation, music, and then it moves into mental, spiritual interventions that includes affirmations, compassion, faith, forgiveness, gratitude, meditation, optimism, prayer, relaxation exercises, serving or helping others, social support, stress reduction, and visualization. Again, for each of these, there is research, what to do to strengthen yourself against cancer, and interviews with experts for many of these. You will hear interviews with 30 cancer or related experts on mental, spiritual interventions, such as forgiveness, gratitude, faith, and compassion. You'll hear about omega-3s, genetically modified organisms, genetically modified food, plant-based and other nutritional diets, smoking cessation, chemical and mental carcinogens, immune builders, music, and much, much more. So I hope this will be helpful to you and will help in preventing cancer in the future. I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show, and I hope some of the information will be useful to you. I invite you to my websites, holistichealthshow.com, where you will find all shows for the past 7 years under the blog. You will also find much of the research on natural ways to deal with cancer and other health conditions, and can sign up for my free monthly newsletter. On my website, beatlungcancer.net, you will find many of the 135 interviews from radio and television over the past 2 years about my book on treating lung cancer naturally and holistically when I was diagnosed 41 years ago next month and given 6 months to live by traditional medicine who offered chemo and surgery. This book was published in November 2012 and was a bestseller on Amazon. You will find endorsements of the book, a place to buy the book, and an earlier one from 2007 titled Healthy Holistic Aging, A Blueprint for Success. On my third website, you will find information on the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation, begun last year and currently in the phase of completing the website. This site is at www.holisticcancerfoundation.com. Information on how the foundation differs from others, board members, research on holistic natural ways to deal with cancer, including mental and spiritual interventions, interviews with cancer physicians and survivors, and more. If you would like to donate to the work I am supporting, there is a tab to donate, and I can offer you a tax exemption receipt if living in the United States. I also invite you to join me on Facebook at my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Carl Helvey, on my Holistic Health Show page at www.facebook.com/pages/Holistic Health Show, and the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation page at www.facebook.com/beatlungcancernaturalalternative. On LinkedIn, I invite you to join me under my name, Dr. Carl O'Helvey. On Twitter, I invite you to join me at www.twitter.com/HolistHealthShow, HolistHealthShow. I wish you a great week, and I look forward to having you here in 2 weeks. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host.